All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for being here. Before we begin, I just want to acknowledge that the panel was developed in collaboration with Jordan Gaspore, who's also a panelist.
Hi.
Together, we hope to foster a vital conversation about how news media can better incorporate and amplify crucial voices and perspectives in environmental justice journalism. My name is Evlando Cooper, and I'm on the Climate and Energy Desk for Media Matters for America, where we work to improve media coverage of climate change, energy policy, and other environmental issues such as environmental justice. While climate change rightfully commands increasing media attention, especially as we witness record-breaking climate impacts year after year, let's not forget that the same industries and corporations driving global warming are often poisoning the air, land, and water of millions in communities across our country, communities who often suffer in silence. This panel is about how we can change that. Environmental justice should be as ubiquitous as climate change. So we want to explore how and why newsrooms can and should center the stories of those living with the impacts of environmental harm, hold polluting industries accountable, and amplify solutions that emerge from frontline and fence-line communities. Today, we're joined by a distinguished panel, each with salient insights into environmental justice advocacy, journalism, and policy. Charles Ellison is publisher of the B Note, director of the Council of State Governments Council on Communities of Color, and senior fellow at the Smart Surfaces Coalition. He is an award-winning thought leader, strategist, and advocacy expert. Tammy Murphy, the advocacy director at Physicians for Social Responsibility PA, merges medical science with environmental advocacy. Her work focuses on promoting policies that protect public health in the face of environmental harms. Bilal Motley from Chester, Pennsylvania, offers firsthand perspectives on environmental harms. As a former steel worker at the Philadelphia Energy Solutions, which was once the largest oil refinery on the East Coast, Bilal's experience highlights the intersection of industry, labor, and community health. And Jordan Gaspore is a New York City-based investigative journalist and podcast producer. Jordan has more than a decade in journalism, will bring critical insights into how journalists can uncover and drive stories about environmental justice. Brief run of show. We'll have panelist questions for about 30 to 35 minutes, and then we'll have audience QA for about 30 minutes, 35 minutes, and time permitting, we'll do brief closing statements. With that, enough from me. Let's turn to our distinguished panel. Environmental justice isn't just about pollution. It's about systemic inequalities exposed and exacerbated by environmental hazards. These issues are often underreported, and decision makers are left unaccountable. Bilal, as someone deeply involved in your community in Chester, you have a unique understanding of the environmental challenges people are facing. Mm-hmm. In your experience, what are the top issues that mainstream media either misses entirely or doesn't cover with enough depth?
All right. Hi, everybody. Good morning. In Chester, it's complicated because you see articles like journalists are doing a real good job in Chester covering, but when you live there, you know that our healthcare infrastructure isn't that good. We have the Crozier healthcare system, and there's a lot of hardworking people there. And the childhood asthma rate is four times the national average. It's 38%. Nationally, it's 8%. And our ER, most people in Chester, there's no like pediatric doctors in the city in a small little town, and we go to the ER for our care, and there's no pediatric doctor there. You know what I mean? So our hospitals are strained. And I think, I don't know if you're aware, Dr. Marilyn Howarth, she's like the foremost expert covering these issues. The things that are polluting my hometown, like the trash incinerator, the one I just did a film on, the Covanta incinerator, it produces a lot of asthma, and it's permitted, like it's the only thing there. You know what I'm saying? Like it's not a cumulative thing like they're doing in Camden. I went on this tour yesterday in the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. They're working to make it a cumulative, you know what I mean? The governor worked on that. So we're just bombarded. You know, there's not the proper nutrition. You know what I'm saying? There's no grocery store in Chester. Think about that for a second. There's no grocery store. We have to go right outside our town limits. And it's just a lot of factors that are contributing to the issues there in my hometown. But the people are resilient. There's a lot of organizations concerned residents for quality living. They've been Zulene Mayfield has been fighting this trash incinerator for 30 years, and so there's a lot of hard work, people working hard to mitigate these issues, but it's just that basic infrastructure that we all, you know what I mean, that most of us have, that you can't even fight these things, you know what I mean, the things that pollution is causing.
Thank you, Bilal. Mm-hmm. Tammy, your work in advocacy exposes the challenges faced by journalists trying to investigate environmental injustice, challenges like industry pressure, the complexities of the permitting process, and the lack of connection to the on-the-ground advocates can make it difficult to get the full story. So when it comes to public health, what do you think are the potential consequences of inadequate or biased reporting on environmental harms?
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? No. Do I turn it on? Okay. I just have to speak up, I guess. Okay. Hi. Thank you for having me this morning. Delayed or biased or inadequate reporting really basically leads to further exposure. And those further exposures lead to morbidity and mortality, unfortunately. So a lot of these industries are toxic. And if the community is not aware of it, if it's not made public, then they don't know when to go to a public hearing or when to show up to in order to fight these things. So when people are kept in the dark and investigations don't go deeper and happen soon enough, then the community gets left in the dark. They don't know how to show up to fight a particular facility. And then also a good piece of investigation is to look into who they're voting for, who's running the campaigns, and who's funding those campaigns. So they know who they're voting for and then what they're going to get in return from that. So that's in a nutshell.
Thank you. Charles, we've discussed the critical need for journalists to engage directly with marginalized communities, and for non-white media outlets to also drive these conversations. Could you share some specific strategies on how journalists, especially those in mainstream media, can do this respectfully and effectively?
Right, yeah. Thank you so much, Evlando, for bringing us all together, having this conversation, facilitating it. So it's been a long journey to finally meeting you in person.
Yes.
We've been doing this virtually for some time. So great question. First, it's all about understanding that the environment, all things environment, all things climate crisis is every day. It's not just Earth Day, right? So we're coming up on this very special day, and it feels like environmental awareness or climate crisis coverage is all centered around Earth Day. I'm growing very tired of that. It's like Black History Month, right? Where we don't celebrate, we don't tend to have any special awareness around Black history, which is very important history, which is American history, until we get around to February. And so I had a recent experience with a very prominent publication that I was pitching to on behalf of myself and also on behalf of a client for some environmental content. And they said, okay, well, we're coming up on Earth Day anyway. I said, well, let's talk about perhaps doing this on a regular basis. They said, well, you know, let's just talk about it for Earth Day. We're on the brink here. We're literally on the precipice. And all we can think about is just one day out of 365. So first, it's media understanding that it's not just Earth Day. Second, it's literacy. Right, we have to understand and we have to somehow break through this illiteracy crisis that we have in America. So we have to understand, journalists have to grasp and they have to figure out a way to navigate around the fact that more than half of American adults can't read beyond a 6th to 8th grade level. That's a fact. So that's why we have such rampant disinformation. That also reflects low scientific literacy rates. That's why there's rampant disinformation and lack of awareness around major and critical science issues like the climate crisis. Barely a quarter of adults understand science, right? And that's even worse as it relates to our young people who are coming up and trying to learn science and STEM issues. So literacy is real key, especially civic literacy. Majority of adults don't know their three branches of government. They don't know the difference between a state capital and the U.S. capital. So as a result, you know, they're looking at all this coverage of climate and environmental politics or what's necessary in terms of policy prescriptions for the environmental problems and climate crisis problems that we face and the need for solutions. They're looking at all this coverage, but they don't understand what the various maneuvers are taking place in state legislatures on Capitol Hill, what the presidential race means in relation to these real big decisions we have to make as voters with respect to the climate crisis. Also, thirdly, it's about perspective. Mainstream media outlets especially need to include more perspectives. And just understand that, you know, this is something to celebrate. We're a diverse society. So let's capture all the diversity of those perspectives in that reporting. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, and you know, it's funny, I have these conversations all the time, and we see these conversations all the time where media outlets lament how they're losing audience. Well, it's not just social media that's siphoning away your audience. It's also the fact that you're not allowing room for more perspectives. You're not being diverse in your reporting. You're not showing reporting that's capturing all this infinite array of diverse experiences, what black people are dealing with in cities like Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a cesspool of environmental and climate crisis issues. I know because I grew up in Philadelphia. I grew up in North Philadelphia. So I know all about it. It's the poorest big city in the country. So we need to allow mainstream media outlets, and this also applies to non-mainstream, non-white media outlets, they need to allow for more perspectives. And understand, I mean, I was just seeing the Nielsen report recently showing how black media consumers are the largest or the most active of media consumers out of all the racial groups. So understand that, embrace that. And that can lead to some creative and innovative programming in terms of doing that. And when you allow for more perspectives, when you understand there's a literacy crisis, then you get into translation of very complex issues. Make these issues of the environment. This is a real important point here, and then I'll wrap up. I hope I have like a couple more minutes. So this is a real important point. And I learned this over 7 years of broadcasting on WURD, a major radio station, a black radio station based here in Philadelphia. You have to make this type of reporting, this type of conversation on the environment, on climate crisis, you have to make it relevant. You have to tailor it for different population groups, right? You have to understand that, you know, so like you were talking about Chester, right? You know, Chester, yeah, they're dealing with, or places like Philadelphia. They may not see the challenges that they're dealing with as environmental issues or climate crisis issues, but definitely, sure, yes, indeed, those issues, those challenges that you are dealing with in places like Chester or North Philadelphia or South Philadelphia or elsewhere are indeed environmental issues. They're intersecting with environmental issues. They're aggravated by what's troubling us in terms of our environment. So you have to make those conversations or that reporting much more relevant, right? So, you know, in Philadelphia here, for example, let's take an example here, or any other major city, right? Hot summers, urban heat island impacts lead to higher violent crime rates or spikes in violent crime or lead to higher rates of asthma or respiratory illness or lead to people being affected by or dying from heat exposure or, you know, high, you know, certain pollution rates or the presence of plastic toxicity in some areas more than others, say in black and brown areas more than that leads to some other major illnesses or the presence, the prominence of many major illnesses and cancers in those communities than others. You know, so when you start, you know, addressing the challenges and the troubles that they're dealing with on the ground, that they're really, that those populations, those marginalized, underserved populations are being affected by, then they start understanding, then it starts to click. Instead of you talking about or mainstream media outlets or other journalist outlets or journalists talking about, and this is important, yeah, you know, the glaciers are melting, the sea levels are rising, the planet is warming, but I can tell you that people who are living on my block or growing up on my block back in North Philly, the farthest thing away from their minds right now is the glaciers on you know, that are melting at the North Pole. However, if you do have a conversation with them about, and you start saying, hey, you know, you're dealing with this issue called urban heat islands. It's making it hotter where you live because you have fewer trees, because you also have dark roofing, or because it's hotter where you are compared to middle to upper income, mostly white neighborhoods in the suburbs. You know, I can show you a way. If you transform this place, the space you live in, I can show you a way to cool it down. And, oh, by the way, I can also reduce crime impacts. I can enhance public safety in your neighborhood. I can also reduce asthma rates. I can do a number of things. Or, oh, by the way, there are 50,000 vacant lots in the city of Philadelphia alone. If you transform those vacant lots, you turn them into green spaces, I can make your air cleaner. Or, oh, by the way, and oh, by the way, too, I know you're dealing with high unemployment rates or low employment in your neighborhoods or in your communities. I can create more jobs for you. I can actually also find opportunities for you to create small businesses. Oh, hey, oh, by the way, we want all that solar energy, that clean energy that we want to develop, that clean energy, renewable energy conversation that we're having that you think has nothing to do with you, has a lot to do with you, because we can create more jobs and we can start more businesses in your communities. So you have to make it rough. So that's where when you start making those conversations and those narratives much more relevant and tailored for those communities, things start to click. So it's taking those very complex conversations and translating them, making them relevant, and then it all works, it all comes together, and we all understand that we're in it together.
Thank you for that. And Jordan, piggybacking a little bit off some of Charles's answer, as far as things that journalists can do, these environmental stories, these environmental injustice stories, are often involve navigating complex bureaucratic processes and delayed releases of information. So what are some other techniques that journalists can use to piece together the bigger picture, especially when there's like an active effort to minimize or downplay potential dangers?
Yeah, I mean, I'll front load a little bit, and to Charles's point about only doing coverage or media outlets only wanting to focus on environmental coverage during Earth Day, that I've had experiences in other workplaces where, so talking about the urban heat island effect, where, oh, we can't have any stories about heat because it's not summertime. So nobody is going to care about these stories. And I actually had an executive producer say, no one is going to care about this until the summer. So like, if you want to hold off on the story, we can maybe publish it June, July, and August. So even after making a point that people still live with these issues, and instead of being reactive, being proactive to these issues, it was still a no. And I'll also say too, even this morning, I've been working for about a year with a pretty major media outlet on an investigation in the Gowanus neighborhood in Brooklyn in New York. And the reason there's been a lot of holdup is I've had this editor say that they do not trust community members in this neighborhood, and that the information that they're giving us, we need to, you know, obviously we're going to fact check what they say, but trying to minimize the voices of the community because they're either too advocacy, they're advocates, they're anti-development. There's been a lot of back and forth on how much information from community members who have been there for decades, how much we're going to include their voices in that story. So there's been pushback from there. And also during a call I had this morning for this story, because it's top of mind, that made me like a red flag. We were talking to an environmental lawyer who works with clients who are developing in Gowanus. And I use this as an example, where he said the historical industrial, you know, contamination in Gowanus, that information has been made public. Like, there's nothing really to reveal here, because you can go to the Brooklyn Library, for instance, and ask for the DEC binder with the information. You can go on the DEC website, the Department of Environmental Conservation, you can go on their website, and all the information's public. My rebuttal was, for the past year working on the story, I've gone on the DEC locator site. I've asked for this binder. You see this information, and as someone even with a master's degree and who spent years doing journalism, this information is so complex and confusing that to say the community should not be up in arms about this because they knew the information was always public, they just had to look, okay? And they know, and there's community meetings. They could always come out to the community meetings and ask these questions to the DEC. I've been to these community meetings. They're like science fairs. And you go and you even get more confused because one DEC representative tells you one thing, and then you go to the other booth, talk the same, you're asking the same question. They give you another information, and it's conflicting. And that's just been a real burden. But I guess what I want to say here in all is just the distrust of what community members have to say by editors. And, you know, sometimes even feeling like, wow, am I getting gaslit? Or like, wait, or should I trust what the community is saying if this editor is telling me that what they're saying is not true? Or are they anti-development? Why, you know, it starting to you know, really confuse even myself about these things. But in all, I think that the biggest resource for any of these stories, though, is the community, and the community knowledge of a place is really important. And I have joked in the past that throughout this whole year-long investigation that I've been doing, that two different community members I talk to as much as I talk to my mom, which is every day sending messages and even being like, hey, there was a recent rainstorm in Gowanus. Is everything okay with your house because of flooding issues? And so, you know, it's not necessarily a friendship. It's though caring though still about the community and the neighborhood, but keeping those relations and really just trying to have that trust and build that trust and work with communities on stories. And that's not to say they're going to impact your editorial or you're going to be sharing articles or anything with them or drafts with them, but it's just having that constant communication with them and just learning to trust that institutional knowledge. And it's just, for me, been difficult trying to get other editors to also trust that. But, just really working with the community, I would say, is my biggest thing. But that's my little soapbox for the day.
Thank you so much for that. And turning back to the community, Bilal, you mentioned the litany of harms.
Right.
We'll do one brief round of follow-up before we throw it to the audience. But mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, are there efforts in your community to address this at the local level, at the community level? And if so, how can journalists best support and amplify these efforts?
Yeah, there's a lot of efforts. So, two things. So, I used to work at the oil refinery in South Philly, the one that blew up in 2019. And Shamar is with Philly Thrive, the organization in the community that fought to keep it closed when it happened. You know, so I met them, people like that. So, their sister organization in Chester, my hometown, 10 miles south of here, concerned residents for quality living. They've been fighting every day for 30 years. Zulene Mayfield is an international legend. Like, she quit her job as a nurse and fought this every day. Because I realize I'm not brave. So I like filming people that are that brave. Because I spent 15 years at the refinery not speaking up as a manager. So I always felt bad about that. So, yes, it's people like that, Philly Thrive, concerned residents for quality living, that are fighting every day, like, you know, going to city hall, city council meetings every time, you know, raising hell, you know what I mean? And, you know, they have an environmental march coming up on April 20th, you know what I mean? They do that every year, and just meetings and, you know, articles. So I think journalists, and I try to do this through storytelling, just keep it simple. Like, we're all policy wonks. I love numbers, you know what I'm saying? Like, 4%, 30, but you can reach people better if you say, how many days of school did your kids miss? And you had to stay home from work, because people in Chester cannot afford, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm fortunate I worked myself to a point where, you know, my boss, I'm like, I'm working from home. Oh, yeah, whatever. But most people, they cannot do that, especially in Chester. I know you know in South Philly and Grays Ferry, Shamar, exactly. So, like, keeping it, like, simple, like my latest film on the trash incinerator in my hometown, I could have made a policy for us. But I'm not making it for us. I'm making it for the people of the community. You know what I mean? Like, really to the point. You know what I mean? Get to the heart of the issue. And don't, you know, yes, you do need the numbers. You do need the historical, you know what I mean, comparisons and things like that. But let's get to the heart of the matter. Like, you know, like the children. I think little things that hook people is the children. You know what I mean? Like, they're just suffering. Growing up in Chester, I didn't, all my friends had asthma. My siblings, my mom died of cancer at 29. You know what I mean? I was with four kids. So, you know, It's like things like that get to the heart of the matter. But for us, yes, we could talk about the stuff, but that doesn't move people. Like in my film, you see there's somebody lived across the street from the incinerator all their life and had no idea what it was. Because we just know we can't get a job there, and it's not for us, you know. But when they do these, you know, they build new development down there, and they had these ribbon cuttings, and I'm pretty sure this happens in your towns across the country. They say, oh, jobs, 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 but they're not high-paying jobs to start and sustain a family. Yes, there's dignity in being a security, you know, a security guard, things like that, but that's all you're really going to get if you're from Chester. So,
yeah. Thank you so much for that. And Tammy, we talked a little about scientific literacy. Can you speak to some of the challenges conveying to local reporters the science of some of these environmental harms and impacts, and the work you do to help convey the science so that it's they can share it with readers?
Thank you for that question. I want to honor what you were saying about literacy rates. That's something that we struggle with too, because when you're doing scientific and health-based research and presenting it, you have to make sure that it's readable to everybody. So that's a really important part, and it's like combining all the science, combining the data, all the information in ways that are really digestible. And that's something that our organization likes to help people do. So if you're looking for that kind of help, hopefully there's a PSR chapter near you. Or if you're in Pennsylvania, reach out to us. But there is a really great resource, and we just refer to it as the Compendium on Fracking, but the actual title is much longer. It's Compendium of Scientific, Medical, and Media Findings Demonstrating Risks and Harms of Fracking and Associated Gas and Oil Infrastructure. So no one's going to memorize that, but you can find it at the PSR website. You can find it, the editions there, or the Concerned Health Professionals of New York. And you just look up Compendium or Compendium on Fracking, and you should be able to find it. It's a wealth of knowledge. It covers everything that has been covered, everything that's been publicized about fracking. That's just one example. There's obviously lots of other industries, but it's a really, really incredible resource. And they often break it down so that you get it into like bite-sized pieces. And that's something that our team is really good at too, is taking this knowledge and making it into stuff that's, you know, for people who struggle with reading or for children, like making it into a more visually depicted story. That's been really helpful. Another thing that we are doing and we're working on is creating videos of community voices. So we've been doing this for years. We started doing this a long time ago when the pandemic first started. We were doing tours, and then we had to do a virtual tour, but it was great because we were able to like get everybody's voices on camera and hear these stories about the health impacts that people are actually experiencing. So that's been another really, I find that's in a really engaging way. People really love that video storytelling narrative piece. But yeah, I think that the biggest conversation, the biggest hurdle that we have isn't necessarily the science, though. I think the hardest conversation that we've been struggling to get past, what I've been at for 8 years, is trying to get past this conversation about jobs and economy. And the Ohio River Valley Institute did a phenomenal job reporting about debunking that. Oil Change International has done some really great work debunking that. And I just want to bring your attention to Justin Noble's book. I will give you the title. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Justin Noble. He's been doing some really amazing work on radiation, radioactive emissions, and particularly how it affects laborers in the field, where they're promising jobs, 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 but then they're sending these guys home with where their children's clothes get washed, and then we're wondering why people end up with cancer. So there's a lot to be uncovered, and it's also a really powerful call to action. So the title of this book is Petroleum 238, Big Oil's Dangerous Secret and Grassroots Fight to Stop It. It's coming out on April 24th, and if you're in Pennsylvania, we're going to be in Harrisburg on April 30th. So we're going to be doing a hearing with Senator Muth and doing some demonstration of some radioactive emissions right there in the Capitol. Don't tell anybody. So that's the plan for that, and we'd love to get some more coverage of that.
Thank you so much. Charles, speaking to the relationship of mainstream and independent journalists, can you speak to some strategies that they can use to partner with non-white media? Many times don't have the resources to report on climate change or environmental justice with the depth that their viewers and listeners and readers deserve, and some ways that they can partner with those media outlets to bring the story to impact the communities.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So think collaboration here in this sense will be real critical, and I think that it can be really empowering. It can be really empowering for mainstream media outlets because it will help grow their audience, or it'll help revive their audience, lost audience, right? So, you know, as I was talking about before, mainstream media laments why it keeps losing audience, like the big cable networks. And so, you know, the common narrative or critique is that, oh, it's social media. It's like, no, you know, you need to be a lot more diverse in your reporting. So partnering up with non-white media outlets, like partnering up with, say, for example, you have a situation where you're trying to expand your environmental justice reporting, or you're adding additional layers of environmental justice context to your environmental climate crisis reporting. Let's say you're a producer at CNN, or you're some producers at CNN, and so you go to Capital B News in Atlanta, which I see pulling off quite a few investigative reports that, you know, they're doing some impressive reporting on environmental justice climate issues. So you reach out to them. CNN has the resources and money to do that. Suddenly, you know, I'm just imagining this, suddenly it becomes a daily segment, or maybe I'm at minimum it's a weekly segment of some sort that they do. It's a show. But that could be very powerful. That could go a long way towards signaling to non-white audiences or to marginalized black and brown audiences that, you know, CNN is taking like a new major step. So the other thing is that something Bilal was saying about simplicity, I think that is key. And I think you can, in this sense, you can deploy a sort of dual approach here. You can do a both and. I think you can create the type of programming and language that's of a technical nature for the grass tops, you know, for the advocates, the policymakers, the organizers, and that's important. That's data rich. That has that kind of scientific texture that Tammy was talking about. We need that. We need that for, you know, these rooms or gatherings or convenings like this. But also simultaneously develop the type of programming and language that's of a less technical nature, but that's built for, it's designed for the grassroots, right? And it's empowering, it's informative. So that's what you can get. I think that both and is what you can get. You know, you can get these technical documentaries like on a PBS, for example, that's you know, really attractive to like that grass tops or middle class audience, that policymaker audience. But you can also, in some of your regular programming, and this is not just for mainstream outlet platforms, it's collaborative. So you're doing it on both a mainstream outlet platform, but also, you know, you're finding the resources to empower, because, you know, mainstream media outlets have to go into these collaborations realizing that non-white media outlets have very limited resources. So what resources can you find? You know, are there grants out there to help with this? Are there underwriters? Are there sponsors? Also keep in mind that, you know, especially if you're a commercial, predominantly white or mainstream media institution, this is a big audience. These are big audiences, the non-white audiences, the black audience. We just saw that reporting today about Nielsen. The black TV consumer audience is the largest of all the major demographic groups. So that's a money-making opportunity right there. That's a win-win, I think, you know, where you're informing and empowering grassroots audiences, and you as a grass tops mainstream media institution get to essentially make more profit, generate more revenue, while at the same time you're saving lives, because we're having a conversation about something that affects all of us. You know, the environment we live in, the space that sustains us. This is our life support system. It just, you know, the last thought here, it just continues to astound me that there's not a sense of urgency around this conversation about the about how our life support system at this moment is failing, is in a moment of like it's actually crumbling all around us. And there should be a sense of urgency around that. So that's the other thing, too. If we're going to have any conversation about media and advocacy and also about collaboration between various institutions and outlets, there has to be some urgency with that type of programming.
Thank you for that. In a brief editorial, to be explicit, I want to see some of you on The Breakfast Club,
right,
on The Steve Harvey Show, exactly, on The Ricky Smiley Show. Exactly. Like, these have millions of people in their audience, and they want to hear about climate change, environmental justice. So I just, you know, like Charles said, like, they deserve to be pitched. They deserve to be shared information with. So, because those audiences deserve to know this information as well.
I was going to say real quick, I don't know most of you, but I know the work you're doing, it might feel like a slog, but being from someone on the inside of these industries that was, it feels undefeated when you work in these industries, like nothing can stop you, but the one thing they fear is journalists. I'm just letting you know. So the work you're doing is very important, you know what I mean? So that's all I want to say. You know, like, what did they say? But they didn't fear the community. Like, we didn't fear the community, but it was the journalists. Like, what did they write about us? And they're scrambling, so...
Thank you for that. And last follow-up before we turn to Q&A. Jordan, for the other journalists in the room, could you share some specific techniques that you've used to uncover information that might have been deliberately obscured or stymied, speaking to Bilal's point?
Yeah, I mean, like, going back to an earlier point about working with communities, that some of that institutional knowledge is something that potentially, and has been in my experience, at odds with, you know, I mentioned covering Gowanus, at odds with folks who are developers, at odds with state and federal regulatory agencies. And so that has been, again, the conflict between what the communities have to say and what the, quote, experts have to say, that I mentioned before about having a hard time with a particular editor trying to get some of that community institutional knowledge through into this article. And so that, to me, just has been like a wealth, though, of resource. Again, like, that is my top trick. I feel like, if that's not even really a trick, but is being able to talk to those communities and, like, actually going to their homes, going to the sites, having folks in those communities do a tour of the neighborhood and talk to you about what is going on. And it's not just a phone call, and it's not just an email back and forth or the WhatsApp messages and then sending you photos, which they do, and I've asked when different things go on, but going actually out there and being able to see these things. Because when they're telling you it's really loud from the construction, or it smells, and like, oh, the tent went down from one of the state Superfund sites and there's dust, and you go out with them and you actually see it, and then I take my photos, and then I share those with the editor, yeah, say, hey, like, they're not crazy, or it's not, you know, something that it's all just made up. These are photos I took, and this is the dust. So, like, it is just being out there and going with them and saying that. So that's been my big advice. Yep.
Thank you so much. Now we'll begin Q&A. A few housekeeping rules that I must remind you of. The conference is for Creative Forum by Journalists. So they're going to be prioritized when it comes to asking questions. Please, please, please ID yourself before you ask your question. And I'm encouraged to discourage speech making. So I don't like cutting people off, but please just get to your ID and your question. And with that, I'm going to do this Oprah style. So I'm going to come to you. So any questions? Kick it off. I'll start here. It's being recorded, so they want you on the mic.
Hi, my name is Cassandra Profita. I'm a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Something that Jordan said really struck a nerve with me, and I'm wondering if you have a perspective on what a journalist should do when you realize that information that is being shared with the community is unclear, it's maybe not being shared, and it's fueling, like, discontent, misinformation, animosity. Do you feel like, as a journalist, you have a responsibility to do something about that?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like I have a responsibility to do something about that. And I think, though, one of the community groups that I've been working with, a big piece of their advice has been, you know, because I said before, you know, a lot of this information, people will say, oh, it's been public, they could go find it anywhere. It is using, then, going and finding that information, going through the slog of the site and everything, using their information to get back at them, is how it's been described to me, is that using the information that is publicly available from state, federal, environmental regulatory agencies, and using that to formulate story ideas, but also your questions to them. Because I think it's been interesting that some of this information I found, you go and then finally interview someone, say with the DEC, like I did, and they're like, wait, like, that information's wrong. That number is wrong. Where did you get that from? And I'm like, well, here is the link from your whole document link list from your state website. And they're like, no, but that's not correct. Okay, so then what is the correct information then? Because this is public and this was a community member that brought this and said, you know, dude, that is using that to your advantage, going through those public documents and bringing that up and the questioning and everything. That's been the biggest thing. But there has been a lot of miscommunication, and it's hard, I think, to parse through, too, and, like, talking to certain editors. So I'm a freelance journalist. So that even makes it, I think, more difficult because I'm not actually active in the newsroom as a full-time staff member, that, one, the editor has to trust me. And so then on top of that, have to trust the people I'm talking to and have to trust the community members that I'm speaking with. There's a lot of layers of trust that having to get through right off the bat. But I think that having that information from those agencies and being able to use that, and I shouldn't say against it, but that's how it was brought to me from a community member, but bringing that and presenting that information to them. And then, yes, I have then FOIA'd information that, you know, was, I thought was supposed to be public, and then finding out, no, because there's privacy issues. But I do want to just say, too, that in some of these stories where it gets really the science and health aspect of it, that having, though, the different parts, starting with the community, branching out from the community to the state, federal, environmental regulatory agencies, if there is a development side of it, yes, you know, getting the side of the developer as well. I mean, going back to getting all the different sides, but being able to use that to have a more complete picture of the puzzle. But I start with, I'm going to just, like, again and again say, I start with the community members and the information that they have to say, and then go out from there to use that information in my questioning to the state, federal agencies, to the developers, to the other pieces of that puzzle, if that makes sense. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, my name is Anna. I don't know, is the mic working? My name's Anna. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. So I come from a background in working for an NPR affiliate. Now I'm working for a PBS affiliate. I've worked lots of times with editors who are really doubting that piece of wanting to incorporate environmental justice and community perspectives for fear that it's some kind of like dancing into advocacy. And something that I launched last year at the station I'm at now, we talk with different environmental justice organizers, and I'm wondering to the comment around like Black History Month, Indigenous Peoples Day, Earth Day. I have this series now, and it feels like a step in the right direction, but I'm wondering in what ways now it's allowing people to kind of check off that box and not really implement environmental justice coverage that lends into other storytelling. I wonder if there are comments or thoughts around how to maybe have that series, but to also let that be a bridge and not keep it in a silo.
Charles, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'm going there first. Well, thank you for that too, for that, both that question and that comment, and for your efforts up there in Detroit. So I'm of the mind that environmental, climate coverage, climate news reporting, everything, it should be integrated into all of your reporting. I somewhat bristle at the notion these days that the environment or what we're going through as a climate crisis, remember, you know, this is an urgent moment that we're going through the collapse of our life support system. And we'll find that it's the top issue. First of all, it's the top issue. Right. Because if we don't have a planet, if we don't have a space to live in, we don't have anything. All other issues are irrelevant, even this upcoming presidential election. Right. So I think one way to approach it is to start thinking about how to integrate all the conversation and reporting around environment and climate into other issues. Where's the intersectionality? I don't think that that's happening enough, if at all. And I'm concerned about that. However, I do like where you're headed right now. I think you're kind of going in that direction where by creating a series, I think that for those who are, you know, current environmental journalists or traditional environmental journalists, looking at ways to devise series, something that's frequent, right? It's not, you want both quality, right? Quality reporting to help people understand what's going on, what's happening around them, how pollution is affecting communities that you're reporting on, these communities that are living through it, how climate crisis is affecting us all, right? So you want people to understand that, but also quantity is important as well, frequency, you know, so just saying that over and reporting on that, showing people that over and over again. That's why I'm a big advocate for integration of or intersectionality of different. So, you know, if there's going to be a conversation, like I noticed when I'm watching, like the way I feel when I'm watching local weather reports where I live, I feel like meteorologists should be talking about climate. You know, they're just sort of happily like, oh, you know, it's April showers. It's like, no, it's climate crisis. It's like, it's weird. It's something really profound and unprecedented is going on as far as these weather patterns, or they just sort of point out a tornado that hit some community or in some other state, and they're like, oh, you know, that it was something that was unprecedented, but they never mention climate crisis. And I've talked to meteorologists who are afraid to do that. And I understand, you know, because of the businesses that you're in, and then you have to go up against producers and editors and bosses. But it's going to have to take a bit of courage and some you're just feeling brave. Obviously, us coming together as environmental advocates and journalists, that helps with that. But I think we need to get to that point where we're integrating all these different issues into environmental reporting or finding that intersection.
Can I just add a little bit to that?
Thank you. Sure. Question?
I want to add a little bit to that before we move on. I feel like there's a problem that I have often with reporting is that you'll get this great thing and they'll give these quotes from the community. You've got all the facts in it. And then for some reason, it ends up with a quote from the industry or like the Marcellus Shale Association or it's like some industry remark. And it's the last thing. So I used to be an educator and that last comment is often what stays with people the most. So that's kind of killing me. And that thing about crossing over into advocacy, I think that people are never afraid to cross over into the realm of advocating for developers or advocating for industry or advocating for economists. So why are we not afraid to advocate for those people? We're afraid to advocate for our own lives. It's crazy. So, like, don't be afraid to be an advocate. You should be an advocate. You want to live. You want your, you know, all of us to live and have, like, the next seven generations taken care of. And that's the way that we should be thinking about these things.
That's right. Hi, my name. Oh, okay. My name's Lauren Ingino, and full-time I write about biomedical research, but then I do sort of part-time freelance environmental reporting. I'm based in Philadelphia. I used to work at Penn. I worked with Marilyn Howarth. She's great. Yeah. But I guess, like, related to what you're already talking about, I feel like the disconnect between, like, to me, every climate issue is a health issue, but there does seem to be this silo. You know, we have the Society of Environmental Journalists, then we have the Society of Health Journalists, then we have, like, science writers. So I guess I'm just curious, like, what you even think about, like, the word climate and, like, how do you sort of... I feel like when people think about health and they think about cancer and they think about asthma, like that's a lot more easy to grasp. But like exactly what you were saying before, like if you talk to someone in North Philadelphia about the glaciers melting, like who gives a shit? Right. Like my kids are getting shot at. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe it's not really a question. But yeah, I'm just kind of curious, like does like the climate crisis need like a rebranding? And should we be calling it like the public health crisis or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question because I was thinking about that as Tammy and Jordan were talking. Because some people locally, like working at the refinery, I work with a lot of people that were drill baby drill types, you know what I mean? But they cared about nature without even knowing it. Like they were talking about, you know, they love the fish. They love to go hunting and things like that. Oh, it's less fish. And I wanted to say to them, you know, it's because, you know what I'm saying? So it's, yeah, it's really complicated. You know, like, cause maybe there is a way for people to understand it better. You know what I mean? Like I covered track in an upcoming documentary and a bunch of rains, like rained out a bunch of track events. So I don't know if there's a way for that people to understand it that way. You know what I mean? Or, you know, like you said, meteorologists saying it's April shower. So, yeah, it's, I think people climate, it feels like something far away. It doesn't feel like something that's, you know, urgent. It does to us, but like to the, you know, everyday people, it just doesn't, unless we tell that story in a compelling way. And that's what I try to do through storytelling. So
I'm gonna make this real quick. So something Bilal just said that triggered this thought, but just think in your environmental and climate reporting. Well, first, I do agree with that that point that you just made, that it is time for us as environmental thinkers and journalists, storytellers, to maybe consider a rebranding, and we're going to have to do it quick, right? So you know, so the public gets it. But also understand that the public, by and large, especially the American public, are consumers, and they're very self-interested. They're very selfish, you know. So you have to figure out a way where your reporting kind of taps into that, and you're thinking about, well, hey, you know, how does the environment affect me as a homeowner? Right. So like, you know, there's leaking coming through my roof. And I thought that this wasn't going to be, or how does this affect me as a consumer? How does this affect me, how does this affect me in terms of the price of food at the grocery store? You know, start thinking of it in terms of American consumers, or you know, or the price at the pump. That's when it starts to get through to people that, oh, there's something that's going on here that's big that I need to pay a lot more attention to. Same as I was saying earlier with weather reports, meteorologists need to start talking more about the climate crisis when they're presenting that. And I think you'll start seeing some breakthroughs, or you'll start experiencing some breakthroughs as far as audience response is concerned.
Hi, my name is David Leffler, and I'm with Public Health Watch. I had a question for Bilal, but it might apply to some other thoughts for y'all too. But I'm curious, just because you kind of come from these issues from a lot of different ways, right? Like as a resident of your hometown, and then working in the refineries, and now as a filmmaker. And I was curious, especially from your experience making the film about the trash incinerator, mm-hmm. getting to look at these issues from a journalistic lens. What has that experience taught you about covering communities such as your hometown? Mm-hmm. And when you see, you talked about coverage of Chester from other outlets, specifically for mainstream outlets or from journalists that are not from the community or are white, where do you see some of the gaps in coverage that now that you have the lens as a journalist think, I think there's something missing here. What, they could have done this better.
Yeah, that's a great question. A few things. I think, and this is what I learned, I do come from a different angle, and I think Jordan and Tammy, we talked about this on a private call. The way it's talked about, like there's a way to bridge the divide between the community and these entities. For instance, I don't hear people talking about, and that's why I made these films, the people on the inside aren't, like the people on the outside, the community members think some of the people are evil inside. They're not. These are people just want a job. Like at the refinery, can you imagine just having a high school degree making $200,000? You know what I'm saying? Like no college debt? I mean, come on, let's simmer on that. That's crazy. You know what I mean? So if it was a sugar factory or a shoelace factory, they would be defending that to the death. You know what I mean? Shamar, you know this. Like we had a community, there was a community meeting between the first time the community and the refinery people met. And it was a nightmare. The people on the inside, it was bad. And I covered that. You know, it was really bad. And there's ways. What I don't see is there are ways to bring these people together. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we all care about our families. We all want to be healthy. But I think the way, I mean, journalists are doing a great job, but until you are inside of these entities, you won't know that, you know, these are just people, they're not trying to harm the community. Like, working inside, we did not want the refinery to blow up. The people at the trash incinerator in Chester, they're not trying to harm people, but they're only working with what they have, whatever restrictions. If you say we can only emit 0.2, that's what we're going to do. But they're just going with what the permit says. You know, that's just what they're doing. They really think they're inside. We really think we're doing a good job. You know what I mean? And it's not malicious at all. So when you see when journalists cover the issue and see there's fighting between the community and the entities, I want to see more of, like, the people inside, they're not, you know, they're just defending that job. It's hard to find these jobs. I got friends all around. They had to move all around the country after the refinery blew up. I got friends in Saudi Arabia, all over, and their family's still here, but they had to go. It's hard to find these jobs. So that's what they're defending. So that's what I don't see. But other than that, you know, journalists are doing a great, great job. You know what I mean? So I'm just, that's it.
Mm-hmm. I just want to follow up on that a little bit. One of the reportings that I feel like is missing a lot is the health and safety of the workers, because they're convinced that their job is safe. And I have seen on the other side where, like, for example, I was talking about Justin Noble's book on radiation that's coming out soon. But, like, some of the workers that I know, and particularly from the fracking industry, the amount of exposure that they had, it's so difficult for them to come out into against their coworkers and say that they're sick, or to point the finger and say why they're sick. Sometimes they have to, just in order literally to save their lives. And sometimes it's too late. You know, like, I know a person that died a couple years ago from radioactive emissions that, like, lost all his cartilage, like, was fully, fully exposed into this stuff. But there was no reporting about it. There was no way for them to know. So reporters actually make it easier for these people to come out and be whistleblowers if they have to. So it's a huge thing that's missing. And there's always this, like, the event that Bilal was mentioning was this, like, the workers trying to get it to be a refinery again, and then all these community advocates there saying, like, oh, hell no. We're, you know, it's shut down. It's going to stay shut down. And it was like a battle. I mean, even walking through the door was wild. Yeah. Like, it was – but that idea for us from PSR's perspective is so false, because I have to deal with the workers afterwards, the ones that are sick, the ones who want reporters to talk to them, the ones whose kids are sick after, the ones who lost kids. Like, there is an impact afterwards, and that's not covered. It feels like it's, like, just in a void somewhere. Yeah. And they need it more. Like, I'm not even saying that as an advocate. They need it. They need that coverage, because they're getting exposed all the time.
Something real quick, just from coverage, talking about the worker safety aspect of it, that conversations, like, you know, because I'm a freelancer and dealing with a lot of different editors, is I have had one editor, for instance, recently say, did anyone die? Are there any bodies? Like, literally, and I quote, are there any bodies? And it was, no, but people are sick. Okay, people are sick. How do you prove that there is a link between the contamination or their, where they worked, to their health reasons? And, like, I've had, like, original drafts with conversations with those folks, even talking to their doctors, and that information has been taken out because you can't definitively prove, so then we can't include that,
like,
information.
Correlation versus us.
So I just wanted to say, like, the struggle, you know, between trying to prove that and including that information. Yeah. So
And I want to add, like, two quick things. When you're inside these industries, we had to do an annual physical, that's it. But there's a lot of people inside that are concerned, you know what I mean? But when I spoke out with no media training, when I spoke to WHRY, they did a great job, but I'm thinking I'm just talking to my friend, but this is a journalist, this is a professional, and I was just saying anything, like, yeah, and this one time they took my Lunchable, like, but then I was, oh, no, they're going to publish this? So when you're talking to someone, make sure they're clear that this is everything you say. I mean, she said that, but I'm just thinking, just, you know, no media training, I'm like, I'm just saying everything, you know what I mean? And I was terrible. That's when the death threats came, and that's when it went to hell, you know, all my coworkers, and it was, you know what I'm saying? But make sure there's people inside that want to talk, but make sure they're really sure. Because I was just saying everything, and I got in trouble with, like, the CEO. It was crazy. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Monica Samayo. I'm with Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Hello.
So I'm hearing a lot about adding more perspectives of people in environmental justice communities and the importance of collaborations with non-white newsrooms. I'm wondering, how do we better tell these stories, or in other words, how do we make mainstream media audiences or white people relate to these issues and how these communities affect them as well and care about it? What should reporters do or add? And I know you kind of alluded a little bit to consumerism, but I'm wondering, like, how do we make a bigger impact on how we tell these stories?
You know, I think first we have to redefine what we see as mainstream or what we think is mainstream. So I think we're all mainstream, right? So I think that's first. I think secondly, in terms of now how to get the attention of all those, because, you know, it's not just mainstream outlets who have this problem of not reporting adequately or enough on what's happening with the environment or what's happening with the climate around us. It's also, I see this problem with non-white or non-mainstream outlets too. I run into it all the time. You know, they're just ignoring it. So I think it's a matter of, you know, once again, you know, you find those issues that, you know, look at, okay, Oregon Public Broadcasting. I don't know, in Oregon, what are the issues that everyone's most concerned about or that's most important to everyone?
There's an area that's been polluted with nitrate contamination in their groundwater for more than 30 years.
So is that the issue that everyone in Oregon is talking about, though?
No,
you see, oh, right.
It's predominantly
Latino community. Got it. So I'm thinking about like that big issue in Oregon that's even non-environmental that everyone's talking about, and finding that environmental angle, that big environmental angle. Does that make sense? So whether it's in Oregon or Philadelphia or in Washington, D.C. or Maryland or wherever, what's that big non-environmental issue? Like, for example, you know, we were talking about cancers, and there has been, I've been seeing a lot of reporting about the rise of cancers, particularly among young Black women. There's been they're seeing like a new trend, and it's becoming concerning, right? You know, or, you know, so, well, you know, what's the environmental linkage? There must be something going on as far as toxicity in our environment, you know, and then make, you know, find that linkage. Or, you know, we talk a lot, there's a big concern about inflation or about consumer prices in grocery stores. Like, that's where I think, well, you know, once again, like, and I know I'm repeating myself from what I said before, but I really do believe that I think that's where you'll start to see that breakthrough. Find those non-environmental issues and then find like the intersecting environmental topic, right? That makes people understand this is why this is important.
Hi, my name is Wajiha. I'm with the Great Lakes Echo, which is out of the School of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at Michigan State, where I'm focused on environmental justice and climate resiliency reporting. Something I've learned through my time there is that everything is related to the environment. How any issue related to race, like housing, is also an environmental issue. And so I feel like sometimes in newsrooms there's this pressure to both sides things, and like as a way of being objective. And that means that includes talking to developers or talking to polluters. And so how do we navigate this challenge in our reporting and in our newsrooms and make it better?
That is a huge challenge. I guess I have taken it because as a freelancer too, dealing with a bunch of different outlets and editors and different opinions about these issues, that I take it as when someone, an editor, asks me, okay, yes, we need the voice of the developer, for instance, as not necessarily me taking a two-sided approach. It's getting that information, whether or not it's incorporated in the story is one thing, but getting that information and being able to have an opportunity, again, having started the conversation with the community and asking the community even too, like, I'm having this conversation with the developer that you've had problems with, or you've wanted to go on a site tour and see, or you've wanted to talk to them and they've said no or ignored you, what questions do you want me to ask them? And whether or not, again, I use the voice of the developer in the story, at least then I can take that information back for good reason and tell the community what they said. And I'm not always forthright when I'm talking to developers, for instance, either, and being like, yes, these are questions from the community and I'm going to take this information back, or, you know, even that I'm recording you. But anyway, yeah, so, you know, but I don't see this as necessarily a bad thing if an editor asks that. And if the conversation is really stale, one of the things that I have said too to an editor is like, well, they had this canned quote. Is it really necessary to include that quote in here? Like, what does it actually add value to? And also, you told me to only write 2,000 words, and this is going to go over the word count. Like, maneuver around, like, is this adding value to the story? but using those conversations still as being a positive thing, being able to have some of that dialogue between the community and those agencies. So that's my two cents on it.
Thank you. And our last question.
Pressure of the last question. Hi, my name's Lauren Casey. I'm a meteorologist for Climate Central. We're a nonprofit. We produce climate science resources for journalists and broadcast meteorologists, publish and broadcast ready graphics. So look it up. But I had a question about language. So, and kind of the evolution of language, say, for instance, like third world country, you know, has kind of come into distaste, and then moving to like developing country, which isn't great. And now a lot of times we see emerging countries similar to that. I know oftentimes we say vulnerable communities. That doesn't feel great either. I think some people don't like that. Fence line, front line, what is the most respectful and proper terminology when referring to these communities in your work? Mm-hmm.
That's really good question. It changes from day to day, right? front line, these are frontline communities. These are communities that are really, they're in the trenches that are dealing with this. I say this as someone who lived through a lot of that, like urban heat island impacts. I had to live through that. I lived in a house that had no air conditioning. I lived in the hottest part of the house. And then really, I don't know how I got through high school. Trying to study in that kind of environment. So I think it depends on what the conversation is, and it depends on how honest we are with ourselves, right? So real quick, to Evelyn, I wanted to speak to something she had asked earlier. I'll be real quick about that, about both sizing. And it's funny. I mean, I find it fascinating, right? Like, we don't both sides when, or editors, producers don't both sides when they're considering crime stories, right? It's very easy. You know, there's a perpetrator and a victim. And I think that's maybe start selling it like that. Like, the big story here is there's a perpetrator and a victim. There's someone who has an industry who's polluting and has perpetrated this great injustice or this great harm on this community or this on this space, this geographical space of people or this community of people. Start looking at it from that perspective, or start, kind of countering the editor or producer and saying, well, hey, if this were a crime story, you wouldn't be trying to both sides it then, would you? Right? So
my background is actually in investigative police journalism.
Right. Because I think it's the same thing. Yeah. Especially when people's lives are at stake or when people are actually dying from the pollution or dying from the climate crisis. I think there's homicide, there's actual attacks on people's safety, public safety that's actually occurring or taking place. But on that other, I think that's a good, if anyone else wants to answer that, I think that is a good question. It changes from day to day and it depends on the circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't like when they say poor community. Because you growing up in Chester, I didn't feel poor. Yeah. I feel like I could have lived near Central Park the way I was raised. You know what I'm saying? So stuff like that. When I was a freshman year at UConn, and somebody, you're a minority. I was like, what is that, endangered species? Like, what are you calling me? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't feel that, but I get it why they use it. But that's a really good question. Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, marginalized. I use marginalized, yeah. It's because, there's the folks that are being discarded. We're living in communities, or we're seeing communities that are being discarded, that are being disparaged or forgotten about. So I think we just need to be honest about that. And maybe that will bring some urgency to what various communities are going through.
And I think it fits like the situation. If you're talking about how the community is marginalized, as in like disempowered, they've been marginalized in society, then that's the angle you're taking. But often what I'm focusing on is overburdened. Like, we're talking about health consequences, and people are dealing, they already have asthma. They already have a bus depot. They already have multiple facilities around them. And then this facility is being permitted as if it's the only thing there. And we're trying to say that they're overburdened, but they're overburdened with health consequences, which I focus on. But then you also have to talk about all the other things. Like you were saying, there's no grocery store. There's a hospital that's sort of like, not to knock Crozier too bad, but I mean, it's it's spotty. The coverage is spotty. And when you get further out into the rural communities, like, there's a lot of environmental justice. These people are really, really poor. There's nothing around them. Hospitals are hours away from them. So, like, it really is a big burden to take on a toxic facility in that area. So I think – but also marginalized. You know what I mean? I think it's just in the context of what you're saying. It depends.
Let's also, real quick here, let's start being honest about that. Let's start describing vividly what being marginalized is like, what being overburdened is like, being frontline, being in the trenches, right? Because at some point, as this worsens, this is going to be all of us.
That's right.
It's going to be everyone in this room. Hopefully we don't get to that point if we all, you know, as we're reporting on it and if we push organizations, institutions, and policymakers to finally take some action. But, you know, we have to understand, we need to start vividly seeing what various populations are going through, because I think that some people, you know, we live sort of in our own sort of comfortable geographic zones. You know, it's like here in Philadelphia. Like, I grew up in North Philadelphia. I grew up in a place that, even still to this day, you know, it gets hotter in the summers. But then I got an opportunity to go to a private school, and I saw the contrast. I got an opportunity to go to the private school in the suburbs 5 miles out, and it was predominantly white. Trees all over the place. It was shaded. It was literally 10 to 15 degrees cooler during, once it got into the hotter months. So I would see that contrast every day, and I'm like, why do people in my neighborhood, in my community, have to live like that? So, but at some point, if the situation, these circumstances worsen, we're all going to be frontline. We're all going to be overburdened. And so, you know, we can learn lessons from what's happening in current communities who are going through this.
And I just want to make one quick point, piggybacking off what Charles and everyone else said. There were some great stories that about how East Palestine was an environmental justice story, and we pushed the networks to cover it that way. I think we should also expand our understanding of environmental justice to low-wealth, rural, white communities. And the more people we can include in that fold and help them understand that we have more in common with each other than we don't,
right,
we can probably get some advocacy to address some of these systemic solution problems. Anyway, with that, I want to thank the panel. Y'all did a terrific job. Really appreciate you.